This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. There were a lot of highlights from day three of the Democratic National Convention last night. President Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, and Vice Presidential candidate Tim Kaine all took the stage.
WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson is at the convention in Philadelphia. He joins us again today. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Let's start with President Obama's speech. Yesterday he spoke, recalled his first Democratic National Convention address back in 2004. How did people respond to the speech last night?
As you can imagine, for a two-term president going out with pretty high approval ratings, they have responded pretty well at the Democratic National Convention. And the speech was, by and large, he struck optimistic tones. He was trying to paint a contrast to what you heard in Donald Trump's speech last week and really the Republican convention as a whole. And the crowd in Philadelphia liked what they heard.
What did you hear from Wisconsin delegation members about the president's address?
So I talked to one Wisconsin delegation member after the speech, Wisconsin DNC member Martha Love. She's a longtime labor activist from Milwaukee. She said she was moved by the way that Obama supported Hillary Clinton.
It is so heartwarming to me as a woman that's been in the struggle for over 40 years. And finally, women are getting an opportunity and being supported by the President of the United States to break that glass ceiling. I mean, this visual tonight was one of the greatest, most spectacular scenes of togetherness and unity and a brilliant man talking about a brilliant woman. I just feel so comfort that the future is going to be very bright.
Also heard from the current Vice President Joe Biden, Sean, and his would-be successor, Tim Kaine. What was the reaction to what people heard from the current and potentially future vice president?
Joe Biden is really popular at these things. Tim Kaine had a line in his speech, a kind of a refrain that got the crowd going, where he poked fun at Donald Trump's tendency to add "believe me" to what he says. And you heard that at the convention last week. It was one of those rare times, actually, when Donald Trump went off of his script. When he really wanted to stress a point, he'd say "believe me." So Tim Kaine was saying, not the best Donald Trump impersonation, but doing his Donald Trump and then saying, "Why should we believe you?" That got the crowd going. It seemed like that was a highlight of his speech. He's not an orator like President Obama by any means, but the crowd was happy with that part.
So, looking at the convention early on, a lot of the focus was on some division between Bernie Sanders' diehard supporters and getting behind Hillary Clinton. What was the tone last night in the crowd?
You do see a lot of people who are still walking around this convention with no TPP signs. A very strong opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And so that is not going away. It's not changing. Just yesterday there was a shouting match between TPP opponents, Sanders delegates, and Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind. So, that sentiment is definitely present here. But I think what you do see among Sanders people, there are a lot of them in the convention hall. And you see, by and large, when the president delivers his big applause lines, for example, it gets really loud in there. People like what they're hearing. So I think the divisions aren't as widespread as people might get the impression, but they're definitely real. There's still some Sanders people who are very outspoken.
Talking to WPR's Sean Johnson. He's live with us from the convention, the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Let's move to today. Sean, this morning, I understand Congressman Mark Pocan addressed the Wisconsin delegation. What did he have to say?
Yeah, Pocan represents Wisconsin's most liberal district, and he's kind of a rising star in progressive politics in Congress. He had a message that was very specific for the Bernie Sanders supporters, many of whom live in his district.
You know, I talked to a lot of you on the floor, and I think one of the things I heard pretty loud and clear is, look, we know Donald Trump is a disaster, right? You're not going to educate us on that. What we want to know are two things. One, are we going to make sure that we hold the Clinton administration accountable to the things they promised? A $15 minimum wage. tuition-free higher education, opposing the TPP. Those are things that we will make sure we do, and we have to be involved in November to do that.
So it sounds like making a pivot from supporters of Bernie Sanders to an advocacy group within the Democratic Party advocating for the reasons that they supported Bernie Sanders in the first place. That's what he's calling for there.
Right, and trying to tell them, look, I will be that progressive voice in Congress along with others in Congress to make sure that Hillary Clinton stays where she needs to be on these issues, that she's come your way on these issues in this primary campaign because of Bernie Sanders, and we're going to keep her there.
And Congressman Pocan also talked about Wisconsin's most prominent Republican. What did he have to say, or one of the two maybe, what did he have to say about Speaker Paul Ryan?
He said that he started out with a couple compliments, right? And you knew he was going to something troublesome, though. He said, I don't feel good about doing this. Paul Ryan is smart. He's personable, but he basically said Paul Ryan is largely responsible for the gridlock in Congress, and that, you know, he'd love to say that there was gridlock because Republicans and Democrats were fighting things out, but Pocan says he never gets a chance to do that. In his view, it's the gridlock is caused from factions within the Republican Party that Paul Ryan has been unable to navigate as Speaker.
Tonight at the convention, the big event for the convention, Hillary Clinton's speech tonight. What are Wisconsin's delegates hoping to hear from her?
I think with any speech like this, everyone's going to have their own expectations. So here's just a couple examples. First, from Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, who is a Clinton delegate, and then from Milwaukee State Representative David Bowen, who's a Sanders superdelegate.
I think people want to know who she is as a person. Obviously, she has to establish the trust because that's a factor in this race. But I think she's going to demonstrate that she is very prepared for this job. As President Obama said last night, she's more prepared than anybody, and that includes himself and President Clinton, for this job. So at a time when we need a leader who's steady, who doesn't make rash decisions, who wants to bring this country together, she is the person for the job.
This is her chance to prove that she is the unity nominee moving forward. It is so important for her to recognize the contributions, just like the president did last night so eloquently, the contributions of Senator Sanders supporters and the Bernie campaign, making her a better nominee and a better candidate moving forward. That's what primaries are about.
Hillary Clinton not the only speaker tonight. Sean, I understand a couple of Wisconsin elected officials will be speaking at the event tonight.
Yeah, we're going to have Senator Tammy Baldwin will be on stage with a group of other senators. And then Congresswoman Gwen Moore of Milwaukee speaking tonight. They're probably, we don't know what Tammy Baldwin's going to say, if she's going to have a chance to anything. We do know that Gwen Moore is, a very forceful speaker when it comes to women's issues. I think you could expect her to address that tonight.
I understand Gwen Moore has a unique perspective on the Sanders-Clinton campaign. She's been supporting Hillary Clinton, I think, all the way through. Her son is also in Philadelphia, though. There's a story there?
Yeah, so she is a Hillary Clinton superdelegate, and her son is in Philadelphia as a Bernie Sanders delegate. They were both on the floor when Wisconsin cast its votes the other day. Both cheered when the convention hall nominated Hillary Clinton. But they said they've had some conversations around the dinner table on this very issue. He tried to get her to come his way. Didn't work. She's trying to impress upon him the need for him to bring Sanders supporters along and get them to work for Hillary Clinton in November.
And as we wrap up, Sean, you've been talking to us from both conventions over the last couple of weeks. Can you compare and contrast a little bit the tone of the Republicans from Wisconsin and the Democrats from Wisconsin?
For Wisconsin, we had more Republicans with a prominent role, obviously, from the RNC chair to Speaker Ryan to Governor Walker to Senator Johnson. So from a Wisconsin perspective, there was that. I think the conventions as a whole, the Democratic convention's been a little more tightly scripted, a little more TV ready, I think. The crowd has stayed steadily pretty large, whereas the Republican convention would at times empty. in the arena. So this thing, you know, that's one of the noticeable things when these events are really designed to give the candidates a PR bump in the polls. That's the kind of stuff that can matter.
Sean, thanks for your coverage over the last couple of weeks.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us from the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
Our next guest says there's a common thread running through what she calls the country's culture of violence. Men. Men are responsible for 98% of mass shootings in the United States, and 90% of those who commit homicide by any means are also male.
Our guest argues that with statistics like that, it pays to start gathering research about why that is.
Melissa Batchelor-Warnke is a journalist based in California and is currently interning at the Los Angeles Times. Melissa, welcome to Central Time. Hi, Melissa. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Perfect. Thank you. Well, what got you started thinking about the way gender relates to violence here in the United States?
Well, as you know, as reporters right now in America at daily papers, daily outlets, our job is to sit with the day's events. And if you're a reporter at a national outlet in America right now, you're reporting on gun violence constantly. So, you know, we're talking about Dallas, we're talking about Baton Rouge, we're talking about Minnesota, Orlando. And so what opinion writers are asked to do is take it a step further. So not just what's happening, but what could or should be happening and what's keeping us from getting there. So, you know, I've been sitting with these issues for a long time, and I just sort of started thinking about, you know, how we could be ignoring gender as a shared component. If 98% of the police officers who killed civilians were Indian American, you know, if 98% of mass shooters were Jewish, you could be sure that we'd be talking about it. And so it seemed like a huge gap that I wanted to explore.
You also had a moment, a personal moment, at the Los Angeles Times, it sounds like, where there was an alarm pulled and you realized some of your assumptions and what they were.
Absolutely. You know, just a normal fire drill, which are usually an opportunity for people to grumble and take their coffee and go downstairs. And for the first time, I just, instead of thinking about, you know, this is a drill, it's a mistake, I thought there's a shooter on the premises. And I didn't have any vision of what that, you know, religion or race or anything of that person would be, but I was positive that person would be male. And that's how I got started thinking about this.
And it turns out the statistics, they largely back you up. And you point out in your piece that women are less likely to kill strangers. So that means most perpetrators of mass violence, they're men. What does that tell us?
Absolutely. I mean, there are so many different theories about this, and they're really complicated. We can get into them a little bit further. But one of the things that I thought was particularly interesting is that, you know, women and men alike, when they started reading the article and sort of realizing how wide the gap in statistics are, for instance, when women commit murder, their victim's a stranger just 7% of the time. When men commit murder, their victim is a stranger 25% of the time. So we're talking about huge gaps. They all sort of started responding and sharing and just opening up the conversation. Because as I wrote in the piece, I'm not an academic, but I have worked as a crime reporter and I have written on gun violence. And this one connection was so obvious that I just sort of started writing to explore it for myself. And then, you know, in 10 days, 500,000 people have read this article. So I don't have all of the answers, but I'm overjoyed to see that it's landing in the hands of some people who might.
You mentioned earlier the statistics looking at gender and law enforcement and police-involved killings. What was that number again?
In police-involved killings, it's women are 12.7% of sworn police personnel, but only 5% of citizen complaints for excessive force involve them, and they're much, much less likely to be involved in any sort of crime. So we really do need more statistical analysis on this, because one of the things that we don't know is, for instance, are women taking less assignments that would put them in a position where they would actually be in a position to kill somebody? We don't know broken down within police departments yet, and that's something the Times editorial board has written about at great length, is we have a real need for more data on policing so we can break it down.
And it sounds as though you're also wondering if there are more women in law enforcement and women are less likely than men by quite a bit to kill strangers, maybe some of these mass shootings, those numbers will decrease.
Exactly, because these things are, a lot of the violence that we're seeing in our country right now is in response to each other, you know. There's a lot of fury and misunderstanding and anger, and, you know, it's playing a role in the speeches, you know, that we've seen at the conventions, and all of this stuff builds off of each other. So all that I'm arguing for is, let's talk about it, let's try some research studies, let's try a pilot. You know, let's just be a little bit more creative about this issue rather than sitting back and saying, yeah, well, I guess when somebody kills somebody, it's always a man anyhow. You know, it's, what do we do with the information that we have? And I think we can do a heck of a lot more with even the little information that we have about gun violence in this country.
We're talking right now with Melissa Batchelor-Warnke. She is a journalist based in California, currently interning at the Los Angeles Times. And she recently wrote an opinion piece about gender and violence. You could read that piece, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. And Melissa, you've been talking about how the things that you've been writing about here with gender and violence, that this is an understudied area and has been for some time. Why do you think that is?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, honestly, there is this sort of situation in academia where PhDs are rewarded for writing super, super niche theses so that they can be the first, the most innovative, et cetera. And so you end up having a dusty pile of papers that, you know, are read by four people. I think this is such, and academia rewards that. It's actually necessary for people to participate in that. I think that this is such a big area that it just seems like something that someone would have already done. And yet, when I started digging into it, I recognized that people really hadn't. I mean, some of the best, you know, and only studies on the gender and policing stuff were from 2003. You know, we're 13 years out from that. We live in a different society now. And there are some theories, you know, neuroscientists and evolutionary psychologists.
Melissa, are you still with us? I think we may have lost her. That was Melissa Batchelor-Warnke, and she's been talking to us about her recent piece in the Los Angeles Times looking at gender and violence. You can read her piece over on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's whooping crane hatching season. In the past, the first thing Wisconsin's captive-raised chicks saw when they opened their eyes was a human in a crane costume.
This year is different. For the first time, chicks bred in captivity will learn from an actual adult whooping crane how to act like a crane. This is part of a partnership that hopes to reestablish a migratory population of whooping cranes east of the Mississippi River.
With us now is Anne Lacey, crane research coordinator with the International Crane Foundation. Anne, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Well, let's talk about how these chicks imprint, I guess is the word. Why are we changing from the human in the big crane costume to the actual adult cranes?
Oh, I wish it was as easy to explain in a few sentences as that, but I'll try to boil it down to the fine points. They're in continually trying to learn more about how these birds learn and how we can make them successful parents in the future. Basically, it was decided, you know what, let's try something more natural. And, you know, this whole process is semi-artificial. You know, these are birds that are bred in captivity. They are all products of captive birds. And so instead of trying to be a crane parent in a costume, we thought, you know what, we have great crane pairs here at our facility in Baraboo, and we also have a partner, the U.S. Geological Service has a research facility in Patuxent, Maryland, and they also have a very large population of whooping cranes in captivity. So those two institutions and also the Calgary Zoo up in Canada are all contributing parent-raised birds for Wisconsin reintroduction this year. So it's been done as a pilot for the past 3 years, and we just decided this year we're going to see what a cohort of all parent-raised chicks will do. Unfortunately, we have to wait about 5 years to see see how they might be as parents, but we're optimistic.
What kinds of questions do you want to answer as you embark on this new part of the journey?
Well, I think it really boils down to we need to make this a sustainable population. That is, the bottom line of success is this population self-sustaining. They make more of themselves out in the wild. So we don't have to hatch eggs. We don't have to do artificial insemination for genetic variability and supplement. And if they can do it themselves, it's a success. So that hasn't been happening yet. And we're 15 years into the project, you know, and it takes 5 years to even get to the point where they are nesting. So it's still a very, very young project when it, you know, comes down to it. These are long-lived birds, and it takes them a long time to get that experience to be able to be parents. And so we do have birds. They're pairing. They're getting territories. They're nesting. They're laying fertile eggs. But we have a hard time now with them getting chicks out on the landscape. It takes about 90 days from the time that it hatches until it's fully fledged. And that's a pretty risky time, of course. It's there on the ground, and there's predators out there, and there's disease issues and all sorts of things. So that's the really big thing, you know, and we have no idea if, as people in costume, are we teaching them not wrong things, but what are we missing? You know, there's real subtleties that real cranes can teach chicks when they're with them 24/7. And so I think that's the big thing right now is maybe we'll try something different to see if these birds will be different parents and if they can get chicks to fledge.
I mentioned a hatching season a few moments ago. As I understand it, most of them actually hatched in June. Is that right? And so where are the newest hatchlings in their development right now?
Well, we had a good season, and we had 26 pairs of whooping cranes that hatched 23 chicks in total. So that was a very good year. But we only have three that we know of on the landscape right now. And they're all generally in the vicinity of Nisida National Wildlife Refuge. Because the first 10 years of the project, all of the birds were released in that area. That's the area that they called home. And so then they returned there, and that's where they set up their territories. So that's why most of the nesting birds are in that area. And so with those three that are fledged right now, they're near or at fledging about right now. So, yeah, they hatched out about the end of May, early June is about the time frame.
We're talking with Anne Lacey right now, Crane Research Coordinator with the International Crane Foundation, looking at some new ways to rear and raise whooping crane chicks. It used to be a person in a crane costume, and now it's going to be actual adult whooping cranes themselves. And Anne, what kinds of numbers would reassure you? And again, this is for down the road, not for the immediate future. But what kinds of numbers would reassure you that this is working and there is some sort of subtlety in these adult sort of parents or caregivers that are doing better than the humans did?
Yeah, it's hard because of the small numbers. So a statistician will tell you that it's really hard to get any definitive answers when you have so few, and we have a rare species here. And so what is that number? We do have a baseline that is assigned by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they are kind of the overseers of this being a federally endangered species. They are the ones that we all answer to. So they have a number of individuals in the population, number of breeding pairs that ideally that we would like in the population, and we have that right now. And so, you know, ideally we would want more than 10 to 12% of the chicks fledging every year. Something more like 25-30% would be ideal. I mean, that would be more natural. Certainly it will never have the ability to fledge 100% of all the wild hatch chicks. That just doesn't happen. So, you know, we would want something more closer to 25%. That would make us feel much, much better about the situation.
I know the hatching efforts and the fledging efforts are just part of the story here. How are things looking in efforts to make sure that whooping cranes, as they migrate and build that migration route, have habitat they need and that they aren't hunted, they aren't shot along the way, which I know has been an obstacle in the past?
Yeah, and we do want to make sure that we don't confuse hunting with poaching. with whooping cranes, of course, being an endangered species, there is no place that they can be hunted. Mm-hmm. And we, especially in Texas and in the Central Flyway, where the original whooping crane population flies through, there is extensive sandhill crane hunting in many states. But there's also extensive hunter education to make sure that everybody knows the difference between these two species, between lookalikes with whooping cranes. Say snow geese are white with black wingtips, for example. So we're instituting that also in the Eastern Flyway, but also trying to go more of a community pride route. There's lots of crane festivals up and down both the Eastern Flyway and the Central Flyway, and we really want to make people aware that they have this incredibly rare species in their community. And by building up that pride, that also might trickle down to people who see this as a form of entertainment, plinking big white objects out in a field. And so we're really hoping that kind of interaction in the community level will help curtail some of this poaching incidents, because it really has an effect on, again, this is a really rare species. There's only about 100 birds flying in the Eastern Flyway alone, and so every adult that's taken out of that population really, really hurts our efforts at sustainability.
And you said this program of rearing the chicks with a person in a whooping crane costume outfit was 15 years old. Is there anything bittersweet for you about ending this, having that kind of involvement for your staff ending?
Well, I think that our aviculturists some of those techniques working in costume were pioneered here at the Crane Foundation, but there's 14 other species of crane out there, and quite a few of them are endangered, and we don't raise them all here at the Crane Foundation, but in other places in the world, they still do those kind of things. So we have international colleagues that we help with those techniques. And there is another population of whooping crane in North America that is being reintroduced in Louisiana. So that's a non-migratory population, and we are still raising them in costume. It enables us to raise a larger cohort if we're people out there caring for them in costume. And so it's still a good technique for that, and the Louisiana population is still building itself up. So we haven't shed the costume altogether. And even in the Eastern Flyway, we haven't decided that we'll never, ever use the costume ever again. This year, we're concentrating on a parent reared release, but we'll keep thinking about this and using different techniques and mixing and matching, and so that costume may very well come back for that, too.
You mentioned these hatchlings are in Nisida now, but how much of the process still happens at your headquarters, the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo?
Oh, quite a bit of it, quite a bit. Yeah, between the birds that contribute genetic material, the eggs that we produce here, some of them we ship out to our partners at Patuxent. Likewise, our partners at Calgary ship eggs here to hatch, and we use our captive birds to incubate. Even if they aren't parent rearing them, we use some of our captive birds to incubate, because that increases the hatchability of eggs. So quite a bit of it happens here, and we also have staff that go out and monitor the population. So once they're out there and meandering the landscape, we do a lot of monitoring to troubleshoot and make sure that they're all okay, and if that helps with the adaptive management. What exactly are they doing that's maladaptive that we can then change things? And so most of the wild hatch chicks are still at Nisida, but we have hopes that our new release area in the Horicon and White River Marsh area in the east central part of the state, in the coming years, those breeding birds will come online, and maybe they'll have different fledging success over there.
And just briefly as we wrap up, obviously as we're talking about these whooping cranes, they're still very rare, but if we want to see them, we can see them at the International Crane Foundation, correct?
Absolutely. One of 15 species of crane, and this is the only place in the world that you can see all 15. And you can go to any number of the wildlife refuges or wildlife areas in Wisconsin and have a pretty good chance of seeing a rare bird.
Anne, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Anne Lacey, Crane Research Coordinator with the International Crane Foundation.
Coming up, August is just around the corner. Summer only lasts another month or so, and now we want to hear from you. What would you like to do before the summer ends? Take a trip, visit a friend, try something new?
You can call us and let us know what you want to do, what's still on your list. You've got a month. Still got time to get some of these things crossed off your list, but let us know what you'd like to do at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.